The new British history bandwagon may have passed on, but the implications of the work done a decade or two ago linger, and may have been incorporated into the teaching syllabuses of universities and schools. In English historical writing, it would seem odd nowadays not to at least give a nod towards the Three Kingdoms approach to the 17th century, acknowledging the importance of Ireland and Scotland to events in England. Historians of Ireland and Scotland have reciprocated by putting their national histories into an archipelagic context. There have also been attempts to draw close parallels between Ireland and Scotland, suffering as they did from similar levels of interference from their awkward neighbour. But even at the heyday of British history, such parallels never really went further than speculation, inspired perhaps by modern political concerns. And the supporting in-depth research tended to be drawn from the theses of students supervised by the proponents. This paper seeks to ask the question, can the experiences of Ireland and Scotland in this period usefully be compared? By looking at a topic that should epitomise such a comparative study, the elections for the two nations held in 1654, 1656 and 1659 for the Union Parliaments of Oliver Cromwell and his son Richard. The Protectorate Parliaments have not escaped historical attention, of course, and the elections for Ireland and Scotland have been pored over by successive generations of scholars. Much of the literature has been obscured by questions of ethnicity, based on often misleading attempts to put the MPs elected into neat boxes. To take but one example, William Ross of Drumgarland, MP for Dumfriesshire in 1659, was undoubtedly Scottish, but he was also a government official with close connections with General George Monk. So how do we read his outspoken support for the Union in the debates that followed? Was he simply a stooge, or can he be seen as representative of a strand of opinion within Scotland? Equally, can an English soldier turned Irish landowner, such as Colonel Henry Ingoldsby, who married the daughter of a local grandee and sided politically with the old Protestant interest, be distinguished from his Irish Protestant colleagues? These are interesting questions, and ones that I've tried to address elsewhere. But concentrating on the MPs themselves does not help to answer all the questions concerning these elections, such as what was supposed to happen, what did happen, and what influences were at play. The first of these questions, what was supposed to happen, can be answered fairly easily. Under the Cromwellian Protectorate, representation in the two nations was clearly expected to be closely coordinated. The instrument of government, the founding document of the Protectorate, stipulated that England would elect 400 MPs and Ireland and Scotland 30 each, and laid out stringent rules concerning the qualifications of both MPs and voters, which was mostly to weed out of former royalists who hadn't conformed. But otherwise, the instrument gave very few details. The Scottish Union Ordinance of April 1654 did not mention elections at all, and it was left to a separate ordinance in the following June to provide details of the distribution of seats. On the same day, an ordinance for elections in Ireland was also proclaimed. So these two ordinances were clearly designed to be a pair, with identical introductions and similar formats. But even at this early stage, there were clear differences of approach towards the two nations. The distribution of seats in Ireland was better thought out. The nation was divided into its four traditional provinces, with Leinster having 10 seats, Ulster 7, Munster 9, and Connaught only 4, presumably reflecting the level of Protestant population in each, with adjustments made for political reasons. Once the provinces had received their allocation, the borough and shire seats were then sorted out, and the counties were amalgamated into 13 constituencies, usually returning two MPs. The boroughs were joined together into 7 small groups, with each returning one MP. The places of election in each constituency were specified in the document, and although garrisons were clearly preferred as locations, geographical considerations may also have been taken into account. The overall impression is that those drawing up the Irish Ordinance knew the country fairly well and were making sensible decisions based on that knowledge. The distribution of seats in Scotland was less well handled. The shires were amalgamated in a similar way to Ireland, but there was no attempt to ensure the groupings fitted together naturally. Instead, it appears that lines were drawn on a map, and often it seems that the map itself was discarded. To take one example, the constituency of Dunbartonshire, Argyllshire and Bute was not a very happy grouping, straddling the Highland line and including lowland lairds and a dominant figure like the Marquess of Argyll. The location of the elections in Scotland was at times left rather vague. Rather than specifying a particular meeting place, in most cases the contests were to be held in the same shire. And each Scottish shire constituency returned only one MP. The Irish county constituencies had two, usually. And the borough constituencies in Scotland did not fit in with the shires. And an effort was evidently made to allow every royal borough, a former royal borough, a chance of representation, although a few escaped the net. Stranraer, as a royal borough since 1617, was not one of those included on the list. The borough constituencies that emerged were unwieldy groups, sometimes spread over enormous areas. There were, for instance, seven Peebles boroughs, but they were in five shires in the Lowlands of Scotland. And while the St Andrews boroughs, as they were called, were all in Fife, there were 13 of them, some barely the size of villages. Bad weather sometimes made these conglomerations completely unworkable. In 1659, for example, Selkirk and Peebles were unable to send representatives to the election at Lauder because of floods on the one and only road there. It is already clear that even at the theoretical level there were considerable differences in the electoral systems for Ireland and for Scotland. But what of the conduct of the elections themselves and who decided the outcome? In what follows, I shall compare the Scottish boroughs with the Irish boroughs, the Scottish shires with the Irish counties, and finally look at the disputes that arose at election time and the varying degree of governmental interference across the three parliaments. The surviving records concerning the Scottish boroughs provide ample evidence that their elections during the Protectorate followed a very traditional procedure that used for the Scottish Parliament, with each borough sending a commissioner as their delegate to attend a meeting to choose the MP. Traditional forms were clearly of great importance to the boroughs themselves, with the Convention of Royal Boroughs insisting to the government in 1654 that the old forms of conducting elections must be preserved. And this demand was surprisingly successful. The election indentures and the borough records indicate that commissioners from each borough attended the returns for the groupings known as the Dornoch boroughs, that's up in the northeast, the Dumfries boroughs in the southwest, the Forfar boroughs, and the Peebles boroughs. The records for the Lanark boroughs, that's a grouping which included Glasgow, Lanark, Ayr, and Dumbarton, provide considerable detail of how elections were choreographed, and again they seem to be following a very traditional pattern. The choosing of the commissioners was something of a public spectacle. In 1654, Glasgow, which hosted the election, proclaimed that all inhabitants capable to give a voice should meet at Hutchison's Hospital to cast their votes, while the borough of Dumbarton paid for champagne wine, which was drunk with the governor and other horsemen when the public prayers were read for choosing commissioners. The 1656 election followed a similar pattern, with the outlying boroughs sending commissioners to Glasgow, who then joined the inhabitants of that borough in returning the MP. On the 16th of August, the Glasgow authorities ordered that the election should take place in the High Gallery on the 20th of August. And from other sources, we know that Dumbarton sent a senior burgess to Glasgow and Ayr sent its provost. The exact composition of this meeting can be seen in the election indenture. A complete list of 21 electors survives. And this was headed by the provosts of Glasgow, Ayr, Rutherglen and Renfrew, and commissioners from Dumbarton and Lanark. The remaining electors, called the burgesses and inhabitants of the various boroughs, were mostly from Glasgow, which is where the election took place, including the Dean of Guild and the Deacon Convener of the city. And events in 1659 were very similar. Ayr sent its bailie, Robert Kelso, to go to Glasgow upon the 3rd of January to choose a commissioner to go to London to the Parliament, while Dumbarton paid John Smollett for his charges as commissioner for this borough to Glasgow to join with the remaining commissioners of the seven western boroughs. Alongside these concessions to traditional forms in the Scottish boroughs, Cromwellian rule introduced new restrictions on borough elections, notably the qualifications for voting. Some boroughs were scrupulous in meeting these qualifications and thus avoid the penalties for breaking the rules. In 1654, the Banff boroughs, which included the city of Aberdeen, held no election at all, as the burgesses were deemed incapable of giving a voice. It's not quite clear whether this was a local commander or the boroughs themselves that came to that decision. And in the same year, there was a preliminary meeting by the Fife boroughs to decide how the elections were to be held and to tackle the thorny problem of the penalty imposed upon the unqualified electors. So it seems as if, from the boroughs' point of view, it's not so much a sort of matter of conscience whether they should be involved. It's more a matter of whether they would get into trouble if they found that their electors were unqualified. The individual boroughs in Fife went on to choose commissioners to attend a further meeting, and each was given a guarantee that whatever hazard he shall undergo by his voting and naming a commissioner or MP there, the council doth hereby engage and oblige the said borough to relieve him thereof. So in other words, the commissioners who are doing the electing are being told that if there's any sort of problem with their qualifications, then the fine will be paid for by the boroughs themselves, not individually. Such scruples had apparently been completely overcome by 1656, when senior members of all 13 Fife boroughs assembled and the election proceeded smoothly. To take another example, there had been considerable confusion in the Linlithgow boroughs, which included Stirling and Perth, during the elections in 1654, but this was caused by doubts about the process and not by punishment. At first, Linlithgow considered sending the entire corporation to the vote, but finding that it will be a great expense and troublesome to go all to Stirling, a general meeting was held to elect commissioners instead, so to follow the traditional path. And meanwhile, at Stirling, the Guild brothers assembled to devolve the power of election to the provost, bailiffs and council of the borough. The crafts and milkmen agreed to do the same. And they then selected the governor of the borough, Colonel Thomas Reed, as their commissioner to convene with the commissioners to be directed from the other boroughs at the election in Stirling. There's also some confusion in the city of Edinburgh in 1656, but this time the cause was political. In a bid to secure influential Englishmen as MPs, the Edinburgh Council overreached itself. The election was held hurriedly on the 8th of August 1656, 12 days before most other Scottish elections took place, raising questions as to the propriety of such a premature contest. And representatives of the craft guilds were excluded from the vote, so that, as the Edinburgh Council explained, they might take hold of the opportunity to employ an eminent person of authority and place to represent this borough. This may actually suggest that the ones lower down, the craft guilds, were not terribly keen on this idea of returning English people and people from the administration. But the problem was that the vote was plainly illegal under the rules set by the Westminster Parliament. The writ had been mistakenly sent to the sheriff of the shire, but the city council rejected his jurisdiction. And they raised some doubt of the legality and formality of the said election, because no sealed writ was directed to the council. And in respect, the Lord Provost, being sheriff, could not formally be an MP, as he was the candidate. It provoked fears that the election might be cast and made nil once Parliament convened. As a result, they had to restage the whole election on the 20th of August. And of course, they were very careful not to break the rules at that point. And after the excitement of 1656, the next set of Edinburgh elections in for 1659 Parliament were more measured. The council members assembled and read the writ. And once all the voters, including this time the Deacon of Crafts, were gathered, they unanimously elected and made choice of two MPs. The care with which the procedure was recorded in the minute books no doubt reflects the council's desire to avoid earlier controversies, and perhaps exemplifies the essential conservatism of the Scottish boroughs as a whole. The problems that did arise were caused by uncertainty as to the electoral process and a desire to secure the best MPs rather than any obvious opposition to the regime. The Irish boroughs differed considerably from their Scottish counterparts, not least because during a decade of war, they'd lost what corporate structures they had possessed, and were now extremely vulnerable to encroachment by local landed interests. This was especially apparent in the south of Ireland. It was no surprise that Cork and Youghal were under the thumb of the Boyle family. The election in 1654 was carefully managed by the Earl of Cork, who met with his uncle Sir William Fenton at Fermoy on 12th of July about the election of burgesses. The election indenture signed on the 2nd of August included the signatures of at least 20 voters, many of whom had connections with the Boyle family, either as relatives or tenants or both. A similar pattern can be discerned for 1656, and on both occasions a Boyle ally was elected without opposition. Bandon and Kinsale were also under Boyle control at this time. In July 1654, the Earl of Cork recorded in his diary that he was attended by the provost and burgesses of Bandon, who desired me to advise them in the election of a burgess, which I did the day after, and nominated Mr. Vincent Gookin, whom they afterwards, upon my desire, did choose. The election indenture was signed by prominent members of both corporations, including the provost of Bandon, who was also a Boyle tenant, and the sovereign or mayor of Kinsale. In 1656, the borough's elections again coincided, and although direct intervention by the Boyles is not recorded on that occasion, Gookin was again re-elected, unopposed. At nearby Limerick and Kilmallock, a small group associated with Sir Hardress Waller and his son-in-law Colonel Henry Ingoldsby ruled the roost. The elections took place at Limerick under the supervision of Ingoldsby as its military governor, and apart from a slight glitch in 1654 when the writ was sent not to the governor but to the sheriff of the city of Limerick, causing the sheriff of the county, Thomas Southall, to step in, lest therefore the public affair should be retarded, the elections ran smoothly, with friends and relatives of the ruling clique taking the seats. The surviving indenture insisted that the contest in 1654 was held by a free and public vote of persons qualified for such elections there then and there present, but the list of names appended to it, and the result suggests otherwise. In the northwest of Ireland, a similar pattern can be traced, although the details are far less clear. Although the election for Derry and Coleraine, held on the 27th of July 1654, was decided by the aldermen, burgesses and inhabitants of the two boroughs, at least 45 of whom signed the indenture, it is telling that the MP chosen was a long-time client of Sir Charles Coote, and the same candidate was chosen in 1656 and in 1659. While regional overlords such as the Boyles and the Coots could eagerly dominate their local boroughs, elsewhere there was more ambiguity. The situation in Waterford and Clonmel reflected the local divisions, as soldier proprietors rubbed shoulders with civilian Cromwellians, and several compromises needed to be made. First, in that constituency, the neutral town of Carrick-on-Suir was chosen as the place of election. Second, as the surviving indenture shows, while the return was made by the citizens and inhabitants of the two boroughs, the presiding sheriff was a military man, Colonel Daniel Abbott, and the handful of signatories was headed by another soldier, Colonel Solomon Richards. The final compromise was the result itself. The same MP was elected on each occasion, but he was a former army captain who was also a Waterford alderman. Such an amicable arrangement proved impossible in Belfast and Carrickfergus, where the merchant class was dependent on, but at the same time resentful of, the military occupation of their ports. The MP chosen in August 1654 was a military placeman, but in 1656 the burgesses elected John Davies, a key member of the Carrickfergus Corporation and a Presbyterian sympathiser of doubtful loyalty to the Protectorate. This provocative move led to an intervention by the government, with the acting governor of Ireland, Henry Cromwell, Oliver's younger son, reassuring Secretary Thurlow in London that he had taken care for the present stop of him, in other words, of Davies. It was no surprise when in January 1659, the army once again arranged the election of a senior officer as MP. The only Irish borough strong enough to resist outside interests was Dublin itself, although frustratingly little is known of the elections there. The return of two prominent aldermen, both members of the powerful independent congregation established in the city by Dr. Samuel Winter, suggests that the clique that controlled the city was very much in charge of the process. the general weakness of the Irish boroughs and their vulnerability to local landowners in particular comes in contrast to the situation in Scotland, where corporate identity remained strong and compliance with the government was negotiated rather than imposed, and where the influence of lairds and nobles had long been successfully resisted. So in the case of the boroughs, you've got a situation really where Ireland and Scotland seem to be going on very different paths. There is much less evidence for the conduct of the Scottish Shire elections, apart from what can be gleaned from the surviving writs and indentures. A handful survived for 1654, an almost complete run for 1656. And these include the names of the most prominent electors. It should be added that these electors were probably not the total number of voters present, but they certainly record the most important people there and usually follow an order of precedence, with nobles or sons of nobles being named first. So I think they can tell us quite a lot about what was going on, even if they're not a perfect source. And the most striking thing about these indentures is the absence of Englishmen in the Scottish elections. In 1656, only two elections involved an English sheriff: Colonel Cobbett at Forfar and Kincardine Shires, and Colonel Daniel at Perthshire. As for named electors, only one indenture, that for Haddingtonshire, had English voters listed, and there were only two among 17 Scots named. And this apparent lack of direct involvement by the regime fits in with what we know about the relatively light touch of the Scottish government under George Monk and Lord Boghill when it came to local affairs. A second interesting point is that turnout, if the lists of named voters give an accurate indication of that, varied significantly. The indentures for Perthshire, which survived for both 1654 and 1656, include 29 and 28 names respectively. Selkirk and Peebles Shires in 1656, 32. Edinburgh Shire boasted 34 signatures. These numbers suggest a relatively high level of participation among those not barred from voting by the qualifications. By contrast, other shire elections had a very poor turnout indeed. 6 for the 3 Linlithgow Shires, 8 for Banffshire, 9 for Invernessshire. Sometimes the total number attending was high, but there are in fact very few important lairds there. The remainder being minor landowners, or bonnet lairds, as they were known. And this was a major problem in Perthshire in 1654, when very few of the electors were men of substance, possibly because the candidate was unpopular. Although this was not repeated in 1656, when over half of those named were important lairds. Something similar happened in Fife in 1656, when there were 25 named electors, but very few were men of local standing. Only 6 had been appointed as JPs or assessment commissioners, for example, and the remainder were minor lairds or government officials. There were often political reasons for either turning up or staying away, as we shall see. The indentures provide important primary evidence, but they do not always reveal the influences behind the Scottish elections. The elections in 1654 were disrupted by the Royalist Rebellion, led by the Earl of Glencairn, mostly in the Highland area. And this was particularly the case in the north, obviously, with Aberdeenshire, Sutherland, Ross and Cromarty, Banffshire, Elgin and Nairn Shires, unable to hold elections at all. As with the boroughs, the system of qualifications also caused problems. And this was a matter of conscience rather than rules imposed by the government or the army in this case. Thus, the gentry of Aberdeenshire resolved that they were very willing and ready to serve and observe the commands of my Lord Protector in anything. But in this, they could not but acknowledge that they all came within the compass of the exceptions, and by the articles in the instrument of government, could not see but each man was incapable of giving voice in the election. Roxburghshire also failed to hold an election in 1654, and as this border shire was unaffected by the rebellion, it's probable that this was also through the unwillingness of local lairds, who were heavily influenced by radical Covenanter thinking, to join in the process. Most revealing was the situation in Ayrshire and Renfrewshire, where Monk had to bend the rules in an attempt to persuade reluctant locals to attend the election, assuring one local nobleman that the new vote may be done without hazard, diverse members who were chosen by the shires having been accepted of, notwithstanding the qualifications of the persons electing. This is rather extraordinary at face value, because obviously Monk is the one who's supposed to be imposing and endorsing the qualifications, and he's basically saying that he's not taking any notice of them. And this seems to have become a general rule, as there's no evidence that qualifications hindered the elections in 1656, and attempts in Parliament in June 1657 to tighten the rules suggest they were honoured in the breach. Again, this can be seen as evidence of a relatively relaxed attitude towards government in Scotland. The government also adopted a laid-back approach to the involvement in Scottish landowners in the electoral process. Some constituencies were in effect private fiefdoms, controlled by a powerful national figure or by a dominant nobleman. Most obvious are two constituencies in the south. Berwickshire was under the thumb of John Swinton of Swinton, and he was returned as MP for the shire in all three parliaments. Wigtonshire in the southwest was also stitched up. The sole MP, James McDowell of Garthland, was the head of a powerful local interest group, and he was undoubtedly assisted by the sheriff, who happened to be his brother-in-law, Sir Andrew Agnew of Lochnor. And it's very suspicious that in 1656 the election was held a week early and in the very western end of the constituency, and only friends and neighbours of the McDowells attended. Swinton and McDowell were key collaborators with the Cromwellian regime, and no doubt that helped them to achieve dominance in their shires and to overawe the electorate. A third Cromwellian Scot was Sir William Lockhart of Lee, who was returned for Lanarkshire in 1654 and 1656, and then handed the seat to his younger brother in 1659. His local position was no doubt secured by the sheriff, his brother-in-law, Sir James Hamilton of Orbiston, and the indenture for 1656 was signed by many men who were connected with the extended family. The Cromwellian Scots were seconded by old noble families prepared to collaborate with the regime to maintain their own local power base. In 1654, Orkney, Shetland and Caithness, another rather inconvenient agglomeration of shires, returned the factor of the Earl of Morton, although this was quite a controversial decision and the Earl did not influence later elections. The 1656 indenture for Sutherland, Ross and Cromarty reveals that the Sutherland men, as they were called, dominated, with the Earl of Sutherland heading a list of his relatives and clients in the indenture. The Earl of Tweeddale was an important influence in Haddingtonshire, while the Earl of Panmure seems to have played a behind-the-scenes role in Forfar and Kincardine, and his son headed a list of voters. Former royalists reconciled to the Cromwellian government could also wield considerable influence. Lord Cochrane in Ayrshire and Renfrewshire was able to browbeat the radical protester faction in 1656, but this was only at best a temporary victory. The Isle of Hartfell's interest in Dumfriesshire was more secure. When Lord Broghill got wind of some design in Dumfries there to choose one I did not like, he called on Hartfell to give his support to the government candidate for the shire, who was duly elected, with the indenture showing that the Earl came to the contest at the head of a retinue of local lairds, many of them Johnstons like himself. This recourse to trusted allies among the local landowners was characteristic of Broghill, but it was also used extensively by Monk, and as a broader tactic it contributed considerably to the smooth running of the Scottish government during the 1650s. In some respects, the Irish county elections had certain similarities with those in the Scottish shires. The turnout also varied considerably. In August 1654, the indenture for counties Galway and Mayo included only 5 named electors, while by contrast, 25 were included in the indenture for County Cork. As in the case of Scotland, the names listed on the indentures probably do not equate with the numbers actually voting. And in the case of County Dublin, we have absolute proof that that was not the case. Well, that was the case. No. But anyway, in the indenture for 1654, 13 voters are named for Dublin, but one contemporary claimed the successful candidates received 58 votes. On the other hand, the elections do give us an indication of who was turning out, and by inference, who was not. So they are still useful evidence, not least because the other sources are patchy or non-existent. To take one example, Although 25 voters turned out for County Cork in August 1654, only a handful of these could be considered major landowners. This matched the experience of Scottish shires such as Perthshire in the same year, where quantity masked poor quality. Although in County Cork there's no hint of social or political divisions, and the absence of many landowners is puzzling. Two indentures for 1654 and 1656 survive for counties Kerry, Limerick and Clare, and they show a massive increase in the number of named voters over time. Although in 1654 only six electors were named, two of these were prominent members of the dominant Waller Ingoldsby interest, and this suggests the electorate was tightly controlled on that occasion. The picture was very different in August 1656, when the indenture was signed by at least 25 individuals, including the representatives of a wide range of old Protestant families, and this may indicate a growing willingness to engage with the regime, as the restrictive military rule of Charles Fleetwood gave way to the more benign regime of Henry Cromwell, perhaps. There were also similarities when it came to county interest groups. Although the Irish nobility were mostly tainted with royalism, as in Scotland, their influence remained or was assumed by an increasingly powerful old Protestant gentry interest. An obvious example is County Cork again, where the influence of the Boyles had revived during the early 1650s, thanks to the national importance of Lord Broghill, backed by the regional influence of his brother, the Earl of Cork, and the election indenture for August 1654 confirms the expected, that the family's tenants and relatives came out in force. In the north of Ireland, noble families such as the Blaneys in Monaghan evidently had an influence over their localities, and a similar interest was at play in counties Londonderry, Donegal and Tyrone. And after the death of the sitting MP in December 1657, one hopeful candidate told a friend that he trusted that my Lord Folliot, if a little backed by a letter from the Lord Deputy, would appear for me in County Donegal. Folliot, along with Lord Caulfield, had signed the election indenture in August 1654 at the head of a list of local landowners. And obviously people like the Blaneys, the Folliots, the Caulfields, they're feeling more confident to come out and take a part in local government generally, but that's reflected in how the elections are managed. Other areas came under the control of rising men, often sharing power with other old Protestants. As we have seen in counties Kerry, Limerick and Clare, Waller and Ingoldsby were able to carve up the constituency between themselves. The strength of the Waller interest was a recent development, no doubt encouraged by the removal of important Old English and Gaelic families in the southwest, and it was tolerated by the Boyles, who had considerable estates and influence in the region. A similar situation seemed to have occurred in counties Cavan, Monaghan and Fermanagh, where Sir Charles Coote was able to build up landed and political influence, apparently in alliance with local families, including major landowners such as Lord Blaney. Although the surviving indenture from August 1654 is badly damaged in this case, the list of electors suggests that the electorate was indeed made up entirely of local landowners, and it is telling that two of the three MPs returned were friends of the Coots. In Westmeath, Longford and King's counties, the election indenture also shows a high degree of old Protestant dominance. Interestingly, this reliance on pre-Cromwellian landed interests runs in parallel to the situation in Scotland. Another important electoral interest in Ireland was the military, both garrison officers and those who had acquired forfeited lands, and here Ireland differs significantly from Scotland, where military involvement was slight. In the County Dublin election, held in August 1654, the vote was held at St Patrick's Cathedral. The city's governor, Colonel John Hewson, was returned nemine quadragesente. And in the election for counties Tipperary and Waterford, held on the same day, the indenture also suggests that this was a tightly controlled affair, with the named voters being exclusively recent arrivals, including many soldier settlers, while the presiding sheriff was Colonel Abbott. Carlow, Wexford, Kilkenny and Queen's counties were similar. In the election held in August 1654, the indenture lists at least 16 voters, seven of whom were officers drawn from four regiments granted land in the region. The presiding sheriff was Colonel Henry Pretty. This reinforces the impression that the militant army officers had their stronghold in the southeast of the country, where they had benefited from the confiscation of Old English estates, not least those of the Marquess of Ormond. In the northwest, there was an uneasy truce between the army and the settlers. In counties Galway and Mayo, the seats were divided, apparently amicably, between the old Protestants led by the Coutts and the military led by the governor of the city of Galway, Colonel John Reynolds. And in counties Sligo, Leitrim and Mayo, the military interest coexisted with a strong settler group led by two powerful landowning families, the Coutts and the Kings. In the latter case, in 1654, two old Protestant candidates were returned, but the surviving indenture suggests this was achieved with the cooperation of the locally based English officers, at least four of them, including the governor of Athlone, appended their signatures. The strength of the military involvement in the Irish elections is a key difference from those in Scotland, which were more civilian in nature. But otherwise, when it comes to the counties and the shires, I think Ireland and Scotland are more similar than in the cases of the boroughs. So moving on to disputes and interventions, it was perhaps appropriate that the trouble when it came was caused by interference, not by the Irish government, but by the army and its allies among the religious radicals. The election for counties Kildare and Wicklow in 1654 certainly caused considerable difficulty, not least because the rules stated that the election would take place at Dublin, and this gave the corporation, the army and the government an opportunity to influence the result. Sir Paul Davies gave his nephew John Percival a detailed account of events when the electors gathered at St Patrick's Cathedral to cast their votes. The front runners were Major Anthony Morgan, an officer of moderate politics who was on good terms with the settler community, and William Meredith, the son of an Irish official and Kildare landowner Sir Robert Meredith. Both should be considered old Protestant candidates. This alliance was opposed by Colonel Richard Lawrence and others who supported four rival candidates, Oliver St John and Richard Solway, who were both English politicians, and Edmund Ludlow and Adjutant General William Allen, from the militant wing of the army in Ireland. The opposition was itself divided along religious and political lines. St John and Solway, supported by the Dublin aldermen, led by two religious independents, Daniel Hutchinson and Richard Tye, mustered some few votes, about 30. But the army radicals, Ludlow and Allen, found all negatives, so no votes at all. Morgan and Meredith were eventually returned in what was almost certainly a victory of the distinct old Protestant party over its rivals. The election indenture reinforces this conclusion. The list of 13 named electors was headed by a trio of prominent old Protestant landowners, Sir Robert Meredith, Sir John Hoey, and Sir Theophilus Jones, and most of the other signatories were also local landowners. So, I mean, obviously this may not be the total number of people involved in the election, obviously it wasn't, but you've got an endorsement of the candidates at least through the signatures on the indenture. The County Dublin election in 1656 was also contested, with the Recorder of Dublin, John Biss, being opposed by the former Governor of the city, Colonel John Hewson, and the former Parliamentary Commissioner, Colonel John Jones, who tried to swing the vote, interestingly enough, by asserting that they had the backing of Henry Cromwell. An odd claim to make, as both men were bitter opponents of the new regime. And it is highly likely that Cromwell instead backed the Recorder, John Biss. In fact, the Dublin government did not usually interfere in the parliamentary elections in the mid-1650s, in 1654, 1656, although in some cases subtle interventions can be inferred. For example, there is little doubt that the elections in counties Derry, Donegal and Tyrone in 1656 were stage managed by Henry Cromwell, as both MPs had personal links to him, and not the local landowners who had been the primary influence in 1654. Counties Kildare and Wicklow also returned Cromwellian loyalists alongside local landowners in 1656. As in Ireland, interventions in Scotland in 1654 and 1656 were few and far between. Overall, the Scottish constituencies were mostly kept on a light rein, with only occasional aids deemed necessary. The Linlithgow boroughs, including Stirling and Perth, were of obvious strategic importance as they occupied the Highland line, and their election in 1654 had been a confused affair. In August 1656, therefore, General Monk wrote to the boroughs recommending a very honest man and one who may do you good. And the commissioners, willing to conform to the order directed to them, duly returned one of Lord Brockhill's allies. Brockhill himself took the lead when it came to managing the Peebles borough seats. In the same year, telling Secretary John Thurlow that I had feigned to send for the chief of them and deal with them earnestly before he could secure the return of his nominee. Brockhill's popularity among the Scots was undoubtedly an asset during these elections, with Edinburghshire being the most extreme example. In August 1656, Brockhill reported that he'd been approached by the gentry to be their MP, but as his candidacy had already been secured by Edinburgh City, he declined the Shire seat. Instead, he told Thurlow that he would engage the interest I have there for another member of the administration. In the mid-1650s, Scottish electoral disputes were surprisingly localised in both origin and extent. The pairing of Selkirk and Peebles shires made sense geographically, but politically and religiously they were chalk and cheese, and there is evidence that the more religiously militant Selkirk men boycotted the election in August 1656. In Perthshire, in the same year, there were significant absentees from the list of voters, especially from the group associated with John Campbell, Laird of Glenorchy, which had associations both with the mercurial Marquess of Argyll and with the increasingly restive protester faction in the Kirk. Now, I won't go into the Kirk factions, particularly as Crawford isn't here, they are the ones who are... They are more prepared usually to work with the Cromwellian government, but on the other hand, they reject Charles II. There was also a boycott of the elections for the Linlithgow shires in 1656, and if anything, it was even more extreme. Five of the six named electors were from Linlithgow Shire itself, raising the possibility that the Stirlingshire lairds, renowned for their strong religious views, were refusing to participate. These disputes may have been similar to that in Ayrshire and Renfrewshire, which is very well documented. Initially, the protesters tried to force the election of their own candidate, Sir George Maxwell of Nether Pollock, who was thought the week before to have carried it by a number of blue caps of that party, on purpose, as they say, to have been that party's agent with the Protector in all their desires. But Nether Pollock's election was opposed by the former royalist Lord Cochrane and other supporters of the government, who through their diligence and wisdom broke Sir George's design, probably with the connivance of the sheriff. The result was a boycott, with very few of the leading lairds turning out to vote. So those were the elections in 1654 and 1656. But by contrast, the elections in 1659 witnessed much greater interference by the authorities. In Scotland, there was a more extreme reaction, especially from the protester faction, who until this point had been nursing their wrath to keep it warm. Government intervention is well documented. Monk and another councillor, Samuel Desborough, leant on the Dornoch boroughs to elect a government placeman. The Linlithgow boroughs complied with a request from Monk, working on behalf of Secretary Thurlow, that another useful ally of the Protectorate would be elected there. The four far boroughs also chose a candidate recommended by them. To them by Monk, and the Peebles boroughs returned his brother-in-law. The shires were also taken in hand in 1659. Peebles and Selkirk shires, which had witnessed a boycott in previous years, were forced to withdraw a local candidate in favour of Monk's man. These more overt attempts by the government to manage the elections may have provoked a backlash from the radical protesters. Argyll's return for Aberdeenshire was certainly a source of great irritation to the government. In Perthshire, the protesters who had stayed away in previous years now turned up in force and put up Argyll's cousin, the younger Laird of Glenorchy, as a rival to the government candidate, forcing the sheriff to break up the meeting and appoint the new day. This led to protestations against it, and a self-appointed commission went ahead with a provisional election, which was immediately overridden by the government's supporters, who returned their own man regardless. So they steamrolled it in that case. And in the Linlithgow shires, the election of a senior officer went smoothly, but only after the government had intervened to prevent the leading protester, Sir Archibald Johnston of Warriston, from standing. The general sense of unrest which accompanied the 1654 elections also complicated the situation in Ireland. In a complete change of direction, the City of Dublin elected a local landowner and closet royalist, Arthur Annesley, in what looks like a challenge to the independent faction in the corporation. Discontented soldiers also took the opportunity to challenge the regime. In Countess Tipperary and Waterford, the radical army officer, Jerome Sankey, was returned. But having been elected for the English seat of New Woodstock as well, he chose to, as the quote came, stick to his election in England, apparently as a calculated snub to Henry Cromwell. Low-level resistance might be expected, but divisions among the old Protestant community itself were more worrying. Although in Counties Sligo, Leitrim and Roscommon there'd been no problems in 1654 and 1656, the death of one of the most powerful landowners, Sir Robert King, in 1657 seems to have upset the delicate balance within the Protestant interest locally. At the election in January 1659, the freeholders of the several counties, as it said in the indenture, elected a Leitrim landowner alongside a carpetbagger, a London lawyer. The Coote interest clearly backed the first, and the second seems to have been in the gift of Sir John King, who had originally put forward a friend of his. But on the intervention of Lord Broghill, again, King had been persuaded to arrange the election of the Englishman instead. In this uncharacteristically unsubtle intervention, Broghill had been acting on the orders of Secretary John Thurlow, who was keen to secure seats from government supporters in Ireland as well as in Scotland. Nearer to home, the Boyles were to encounter difficulties of a different kind. In the election for Cork and Youghal, Vincent Gookin turned against his former patrons and stood against the Boyle candidate Francis Falk, in what seems to have been an act of desperation, or hubris, or both. An outraged Broghill reported to his brother that Gookin waited on him to desire me to recede from having Francis Falk chosen for Cork and Youghal, which I flatly denied, having appeared openly for Francis Falk and having an assurance from both those spaces that they would elect him. Gookin's claim that he had acted on the orders of Henry Cromwell, now Lord Lieutenant, was rejected by Broghill, who said that he himself had been given orders to take care of elections here. But Broghill was sufficiently rattled to write to Henry for clarification. He also sent express letters to Cork Corporation and the freemen of the city, and assured them, God willing, I will assist at the election. At the same time, he asked his brother to engage anew all your electors at Youghal. Although the mayor of Cork reassured Broghill of the corporation's fidelity, Gookin's challenge called for direct action by the Boyles. On the 15th of January, the Earl of Cork and Lord Broghill met at Ballymaloe to discuss the forthcoming elections. On the following day, Broghill wrote to his brother to know how many votes we may certainly depend upon at Youghal, and added that, having received assurances of support from the corporation, the masters of trade and other chief men in the city, he intended to travel to Cork City, and that if I come myself, I need not doubt but to carry it. On the day of the election, on the 20th of January, Broghill went to Cork in person, where, according to Gookin, he went to the court and there railed upon me and magnified his own services. And although his lordship had with him but one alderman upon the bench and one in the crowd, and not above 30 of 400 freeholders in the city at the election, his lordship's own people cried up Lieutenant Colonel Falk. In the face of such intimidation, Francis Falk was duly elected by both boroughs without six negatives. A similar dispute erupted in the previously safe seats of Bandon and Kinsale, where Broghill accused Gookin of having played the knave egregiously by assuring the burgesses that he commanded the support of the Boyle family. Despite a spirited rearguard action, in this case Broghill did not get his own way, and Gookin was himself returned, apparently with the support of the Kinsale Corporation. Perhaps the most remarkable aspects of the elections in both Scotland and Ireland were the lack of government intervention and the relatively smooth running of the process nevertheless, thanks to the willing participation of pre-Cromwellian landed elites in both countries and of the Scottish boroughs. This was especially the case in 1654 and 1656, when the light touch adopted by the authorities did not cause many problems. Disputes, when they arose, tended to be between groups that were broadly loyal to the Protectorate. In Ireland, the army provided the focus for dissent. but only in certain areas. And in Scotland, that role was played by the protesters, and their tactic was passive resistance rather than direct opposition. The 1659 elections were a different matter, and the primary cause, it seems, heavy-handed management by the government, was the same in each case, although the reactions provoked were different. In Scotland, the religious opponents of the regime took the opportunity to mount a coordinated campaign of opposition. But in Ireland, problems arose between the old Protestants, essentially loyal to the Protectorate. And it is telling that when Gookin challenged Broghill in County Cork, he claimed to have the backing of the Lord Lieutenant Henry Cromwell. From the above, it is clear that comparing the two sets of elections is possible, but it is not an easy exercise. And there were as many differences as similarities between them. We've already seen how the founding documents, the ordinances of June 1654, were outwardly similar but contained important differences. Not least among them, the fact of having two seat county constituencies in Ireland may have reduced the factional tensions that afflicted Scotland, which only had single seaters. The rights, including the autonomy of the Scottish royal boroughs, were also asserted and largely respected, while the Irish boroughs were, with some justification, add-ons to the county groupings and were thus more prone to outside interference. A further difference was the concern with which electoral qualifications were viewed in Scotland, as this was an issue that does not seem to have arisen at all in Ireland, where elections were held and MPs weeded out afterwards by the Protectoral Council. It's also interesting that three Irish MPs were excluded in 1656, but no Scots were. So it seems as if the difficulties were sorted out in Scotland before the elections. In Ireland, they were allowed to run their case, maybe. With relatively benign governors in Dublin and Edinburgh, the system worked fairly well in 1654 and 1656, and in both nations, traditional landowners were willing to work with the regime and gain considerable electoral influence, while new men rose to take the place of the dispossessed and the disgraced. Largely as a result of this, for much of the decade, neither government needed to intervene directly in disputes, although in Ireland the army presence was more obvious in electoral terms, thanks to the power of the garrisons and the importance in some areas of soldier settlers. Scottish elections were, on the whole, run by Scots, for Scots. The electoral disputes of 1654 and 1656 reflected these differences, as tensions emerged between the old Protestants and the more radical army officers in Ireland, while in Scotland, contests saw the re-emergence of pre-Cromwellian differences, whether between rival political interests or religious factions. In both nations, the 1659 election was the focus for dissent and opposition, with considerably more disputes arising than in the other two elections. These were undoubtedly caused by inappropriate government intervention. But the nature, and indeed unnecessary government intervention, but the nature of the reaction it sparked was rather different. The Scottish protesters were emboldened in 1659 to move beyond passive resistance to open challenge, though it's interesting that they used the electoral process to do so. In Ireland, by contrast, there were short-term spats between erstwhile allies, who in any case were pretty much in agreement in their support for the Protectorate. It might be said, at the risk of some oversimplification, that Scottish unrest was caused by religious intransigence and Irish by jockeying for position. It's also interesting that evidence for collaboration between the Irish and Scottish governments in electoral matters was almost completely absent. A possible exception is the 1659 Parliament, but in that case, the overall strategy was in the hands of Secretary Thurlow and others close to Richard Cromwell in Whitehall, who saw the need to put useful allies into spare seats. And it is telling that the elections for this Parliament witnessed considerable division and unrest in both Ireland and Scotland. The distinctiveness of the two nations and their experiences is further underlined by the very small number of MPs who sat for both. There were only three: Henry Markham, who was elected for Linlithgow Boroughs in 1656 and Kildare and Wicklow in 1659, Lord Broghill himself for County Cork and the City of Edinburgh in 1656, and Thomas Waller, an outsider, for Sligo, Leitrim and Roscommon and the Linlithgow Boroughs in 1659. In some ways, it was all curiously un-British. Broadening the focus, It can, I think, be argued that the un-British nature of the elections during this period had an impact on the conduct of the Union Parliaments themselves. There was a considerable amount of disunity between the Irish and Scottish MPs on key issues at Westminster, such as the terms of the Union settlements in the two nations and their relative share of the assessment tax. And those tensions are worth noting. Perhaps they were the inevitable result of relying on traditional elites whose collegiality and sense of national identity, perhaps, trumped their new loyalty to the Cromwellian regime. As I've suggested elsewhere, the bloc of Irish and Scottish MPs that supported the new constitution and the offer of the crown to Cromwell in 1657 was not a natural formation at all, rather the result of hard work by a few individuals, notably Lord Broghill, who enjoyed considerable influence in both nations. And the ascendancy of this bloc was short-lived. The importance of individuals in creating and maintaining the alliance at Westminster fits in with some other work that I've done on the Irish and Scottish councils, which suggests that power structures within the Protectorate are very much vertical rather than horizontal in nature, with the peripheral councils, in that case, interacting with Whitehall, but rarely with each other. The parliamentary elections seem to fit into this pattern. The reasons for this are debatable. Do they reflect innate weaknesses within the uneasy political coalition that underlay the Cromwellian regime? Or perhaps the structure of the Protectorate itself, which might be seen as essentially military in nature, with a definite chain of command, with a commander-in-chief, says Cromwell, at the top, advised by a general council deciding policy, which would then delegate down into Ireland and Scotland. The latter might help with placing Cromwell within the Protectorate and gauging his importance vis-à-vis his chief councillors. It might also explain the instinctive loyalty of the army officers, even when they violently disagreed with the Protector on political or constitutional matters. And also the cracks that appeared electorally and politically when Oliver the soldier was replaced by Richard the civilian. Maybe the differences between the Irish and Scottish electoral systems are arguably more important than the similarities, for they reveal the fundamental shortcomings of the Cromwellian Union more generally. Thanks.